This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Western Michigan University political science professor Susan Hoffman tells us about public housing's reputation problem and why she thinks more bureaucrats are the solution. But first, six Democrats would like to be their party's nominee for Congress in the 6th District, currently represented by Republican Fred Upton. One of them is Matt Longjohn. He's a doctor from Portage, national health officer for the YMCA. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. And I should say previous national health officer for the YMCA. No longer represent the Y in any capacity.
Noted. Thank you very much. First of all, tell us some more about yourself beyond that and why you're running for Congress.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me. This is an exciting campaign with lots of folks in and trying to unseat Fred Upton and provide some resistance to the federal agenda that he's voting along with all the time. I grew up here in Portage. My dad was cleaning buildings when I was born, but ended up being a serial entrepreneur, helped found a number of businesses here in the Portage-Kalamazoo area, including Portage Commerce Bank, for example. My mom was a teacher in the Portage school systems, and our family's been here for 150, 160 years, farmers, Sunday school teachers, what have you, but never politicians. So I grew up in Portage schools, went to Kalamazoo College for my undergrad, and then got my medical degree at Tulane University, did my internal medicine residency at Northwestern, and as a doc was focused more on prevention than treatment. For my whole career, I've been using my public health degree to help people live their healthiest possible lives. I've had a lot of success with that nationwide, culminating with President Obama's team at the White House naming me one of the top 100 innovators in healthcare in America just 3 short weeks before the November 2016 election. After the election, of course, there were a lot of debates around healthcare policy and a number of other things that compelled me to get into the race and offer up a couple different alternatives.
Let's start there with that idea of prevention. I think that there's a lot of talk about how, of course, it's much better to prevent getting sick than to treat getting sick. But what are the things that you could do in public policy that would encourage prevention as opposed to simply treatment?
Yeah, we have to introduce health into all of our policies if we're going to ultimately bend the cost curve of healthcare. Whether it was the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, or whether it was the Republican health care plan of last summer, which was introduced by Speaker Ryan and ultimately passed through the House by the Upton Amendment, they've all been focusing on the wrong things, in my opinion. Prevention is where we're going to need to invest to bend the health care cost curve. And the kinds of things that we can see in policy aren't just rejiggering our health care system to incentivize prevention and healthy behaviors, but also to include health in our transportation policy, in our agricultural policy, in our infrastructure policy, in our tax policy. We can include all these different levers as means to achieve healthier outcomes, which will save businesses a lot of money and help people live their healthiest possible lives, give kids better opportunities. And ultimately, that's one of the things that I want to bring to this race, is a holistic understanding of what health can mean and how we can adapt our policies across the spectrum of policy to achieve those kinds of outcomes for people.
What would be a sensible gun policy for the United States, and one that would get Matt Longjohn's vote if he were a member of Congress today?
Yeah. So, again, I bring a holistic view to health. I don't believe you can live your healthiest possible life if you're at threat in your community or if you don't have the resources needed to prevent gun injury. And I've been working on this particular issue for about 18 years as a public health subject matter expert. I've published articles and done these kinds of radio interviews on gun injury prevention policy for nearly 2 decades. The way that I look at this is as a public health problem, that there is an epidemic. And just like if we're going to try and address smallpox or tuberculosis, that we need to approach the problem from a public health standpoint. What that means is starting with the data, figuring out from the data in the epidemic where we need to put our greatest priorities. So many people would be surprised to know that in this district and in the state of Michigan, the majority of gun deaths are actually from suicide and in rural areas. So we can't have a conversation about gun injury prevention in this district without making sure that older white rural farmers, for example, have a rural healthcare system and a mental health care system that can help intervene in a cycle of suicide and mental health depression. We also need community-based solutions to intervene in homicide, and that's something that plays out in different corners of our district differently than in the rural areas. But we also need policies to address mass casualties. So we need all of those different angles to come at the gun injury epidemic, and different approaches are going to be needed. I mentioned suicide prevention and mental health for rural areas, breaking the epidemic of violence by intervening in a cycle of violence for homicide, for assault weapons bans and bump stocks and things like that. Are the policies there, the red flag legislation, that's all trying to get into the cycle of mass mass casualties. But as a doctor, I've seen 13-year-olds come into emergency rooms and die in front of me. You know, I've been on the back of ambulances going to multiple homicide sites. And as a public health person, I just believe too many people are dying too early. And we have to do all of those things to improve gun violence.
Let's talk a little bit about economic issues. On your website, you say that some of the trade agreements we have incentivize companies to actually leave the United States. So are tariffs one way to possibly address that?
Oh, well, what a timely topic today.
Sure.
The kind of back and forth that we've seen in the last couple weeks on tariffs, I think ultimately are going to hurt people here in this district especially. This morning we're waking up to seeing news about 25% tariffs from China on soybeans.
Yeah, let me say we're recording on Wednesday. People may hear this later. So when you say this morning, it's Wednesday morning. So go ahead.
Before that, obviously, it was steel and aluminum. You know, that was the U.S. salvo. And actually, if you go before that, the first kind of potentially shot off the bow here was policy related to dishwashers and things that Whirlpool makes in this district, right? I believe that what we need to do in our trade policy is, we should not have fast-track authority. We need to have many people at the table negotiating our trade policies. B, we need to make sure that international labor has a seat at some of these discussions. You know, as I said about healthcare, I believe healthcare is a human right. I think we need to put human rights in our trade agreements. That way, if there are, you know, situations where there's a rush to the bottom of the pay scale, you know, we can have our shared measures be about human rights and quality of life. And if we put those kinds of measures into our trade agreements, then I believe that it would be harder to get down to the minimal token amounts of pay that people get, or you see the labor camps and the sweatshops being created in countries that are driving labor out of this country, that we would be able to go back to those countries and say, sorry, you're not living up to these human rights as part of this trade agreement. So we now have another lever to pull in pulling trade agreements back, renegotiating. But whether it's NAFTA, CAFTA, et cetera, we do need to be renegotiating these things to put people first. But I think that the way that President Trump and Congressman Upton, who's been going along with it, have been moving, does not put people first.
On the broader issue of how to address stagnant wages, what does the United States do for people who feel like they've been working an awfully long time, not getting a raise or getting raises that really don't keep up with the cost of living?
So, since Congressman Upton's been in office in 1986, wages in this district have been flat to even depressed, real wages, inflation-adjusted wages. The cost of health care, the cost of education is clearly going up faster than the wages that people earn. And if you especially look at it in, for example, independent farmers, right? The subsidy program is keeping prices low. We've seen a 50% reduction in corn prices, a 33% reduction in soy prices in the last 3 years. This is before the tariffs take hold. Everyone, whether we're talking rural parts of this district or urban parts of this district, are having a harder time making ends meet. Whether it's a livable wage, where benefits can also be attached to a minimum wage to give us a standard of living that we all need to get through the day, or whether it's by readjusting our tax policy to make sure that individuals are put in front of big corporations and we revolt in some ways against this theory of trickle-down economics. I believe that we can make a number of adjustments to help people get through the day, meet their basic needs, and we've just had the wrong focus for 30, 40 years when we put policies forward that are based on trickle-down theory. We've seen that those largest corporations, the most wealthy among us, don't give either charitably or in the form of contracted benefits back to individuals what people ultimately need to make it through the day and prepare for retirement. Give their kids opportunities, not just for four-year degrees, but for quality of life in vocational training and other kinds of career planning services. That's why we're seeing kids leave this district. We have to focus on individuals and families, and that's actually been something that's been going the wrong direction for a long time. So just like health in all policies, we need to put people first in all of our policies. And the last part of this I would say is that connected through all of this is money in politics. If you follow where the money has come from, you can see why we've ended up in the policies that we have in the tax bill or in our overarching economic policy. We aren't putting people first.
Well, what exactly would you do about campaign finance? Citizens United in favor of repealing that?
Absolutely. But it's not a question of repealing it. That's a Supreme Court decision, right? So ultimately, if we had to go all the way to some kind of constitutional amendment or something
like
that.
Which is the other way, right?
I've actually taken a pledge that if all else fails, right, that's what we'll need to do. But there's a number of things that we can do to make campaign finance transparent, and that should be the standard. We should be able to see who all is contributing to whom. 100% transparency in our system should be expected. If we're going to hold our politicians accountable, and I would very much like to be held accountable to that kind of standard, that's why I took a pledge that no corporate PAC money will go into my campaign. It's all individual support. But if we're going to hold people accountable, we need to follow the money.
You have, though, raised a lot of money for your campaign, quite a bit for a congressional candidate, especially one in a district that, you know, has been held by Republicans for a long time. How have you done that if you're not taking PAC money? And should just that sheer dollar amount worry people?
Yeah, well, I'm proud of the support we've received from across the country, not just here in the district. As I said, for 20 years, you know, for my whole life, I would have passed a polygraph test as of February 14th of 2017. I had never thought about running for office. This is not what I've done. I've not spent 10, 15, 20 years building up political favors or anything like that. But the individuals, and it's all individuals from across the country who've supported my campaign, are doing so for a couple of reasons. One, they know my record. I led a team that was the first team in the history of the United States to demonstrate that a community jobs program could save lives and save Medicare billions of dollars. Again, that's why the White House in 2016, named my team one of the top 100 innovators in healthcare in America. I've worked on gun injury prevention for 20 years. I've worked on transportation policy to help make cities like Chicago more intermodal and to make physical activity and healthy behaviors easier choices for people to make. I've worked coast to coast on that. As the National Health Officer at the YMCA, I helped lead 253 community coalitions that produced over 39,000 changes in their communities all over the country that ultimately impacted 73 million lives. So people have seen the results of my career over 20 years, and then they were also very aware of what Mr. Upton did last summer on the healthcare debate. You know, he did two things last May. He said first he would never vote for Speaker Ryan's plan, and then he did. That was his second thing.
Okay, what happened February 14th, 2017?
I was speaking at the National Academy of Medicine, and this is an institution that President Lincoln established to really have academic debates about the best way to practice medicine. There's also the National Academy of Engineering, and it's all part of the National Academy of Sciences. A couple weeks before I was there, maybe a week or so before I was there, I was speaking on cancer control and on the best way for our healthcare system to help cancer survivors live their healthiest possible lives. And we had just done a study on how YMCAs could help cancer survivors in their journey towards healthier lives. We had 55,000 cancer survivors in one of my programs that I helped lead across the country in WISE called the Live Strong at the YMCA program, and we were presenting the data from that at the National Academy of Medicine. But a week or two before that, President Trump had said, while sitting on the edge of a golf cart drinking a big gulp, that he didn't believe that physical activity was good for you. And as the National Health Officer of the YMCA, I thought it was important to say that actually, no, the science is clear. Physical activity is good for you, and we should not be telling people to be inactive. Long story short, I found that because of some fear in D.C. about making a statement like physical activity is good for you, that not just the Y, but charities all over the Beltway were so concerned about what would be taken away for kids in Head Start or who need summer food programs or individuals who are part of English as second language programs, that charities were at that point in time so nervous about what President Trump and the administration would do to their funding that would help kids and families all across the country, that I was asked not to say that physical activity is good for you. And at that point, I called the 1-800 number for the Democratic Party, and I said, I don't know what to do. I want to say this important thing, but I don't have a voice. And that started a conversation where ultimately folks encouraged me to think about running, showed me the data to show that this district was winnable. I came home, I talked to Paul Clements, and he encouraged me to run as well.
It's kind of ironic, but go ahead.
No, Paul and I are good friends. Okay. I would like to think that that's the case. We have the same
goal. But you're now
goal.
Competing for the Democratic nomination in this district.
We have different theories about what it will take to win, but we both want the same thing. And, you know, my family was supportive and all of that, but it was on that day, February 14th, Valentine's Day 2017, that I had made that first introduction to myself to the Democratic Party. And ultimately, that resulted in me deciding to leave my 20-year career in running against Fred.
Nat Longjohn, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Nat Longjohn is a physician from Portage and one of six candidates running for the Democratic nomination in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District. The winner of the August primary will face Republican Congressman Fred Upton in the fall.